Welcome to the Point Forward podcast with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's J.R. Radcliffe and Jim Ozarski, an over-caffeinated Milwaukee Bucks conversation.
The Point Forward podcast, Milwaukee Bucks chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. On the other line is Jim Ozarski. He is the Bucks reporter for the Journal Sentinel. He's in Boston. He was there on Sunday afternoon, when the Milwaukee Bucks staged an impressive 101-89 victory over the Boston Celtics in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Semifinals. Since we last chatted, they finished off the Chicago Bulls, as we sort of expected they would, and then immediately threw a haymaker at Boston in Boston with a Game 1 victory that I think put a lot of people on notice that the Milwaukee Bucks are very much still the defending champions, even without one of their best players in Chris Middleton. So, Jim, right off the top, this is a game that, you know, I think coming in, the Celtics, rightfully so, regarded as probably the best defensive team in the NBA. The Bucks were not that during the regular season. They were not maybe at the same defensive level they had been over the previous year and the previous playoffs. But we kind of touched on this. You get into the postseason, the defending champs, they know what it's like here. They know what it takes. They're not going to be bothered by a few calls that don't go their way. They're not going to be bothered by even a few games not going their way. And they really delivered defensively. I mean, they just swarmed Boston. Boston again did not get to 90 points in this game, and honestly, like it that looks sustainable to me. And now we'll talk about how game ones never really foretell what's going to happen over the course of a series, but what they were able to do, starting with the big lineup and just really hounding, you know, guys like Jaylen Brown, not unable to really be a difference maker at all. I feel like the Bucks sort of said right off the bat, we can do this defensively. We're just as good as the Celtics, if not even a little better. And they really showed it. And it feels like they could carry that through the series. What is your impression of their defensive effort and the team in general? It looks like a championship caliber team again.
Yeah, I mean, the really strong defensive effort we saw at the end of the Chicago series has definitely carried over. Some of that is because it's the same starting lineup, right? You know, with Portis, Giannis, and Brook Lopez all together to begin. Yeah, it's interesting, JR, because all year long, the question really was not so much could the Bucks flip a switch. I don't want to be that generic or dismissive of some of the good games that they played, but I would say, in the regular season, you know, they would play like elite level defense for a few minutes at a time. And I don't know. I mean, you do that for 82 games. I think it's fair to wonder, like, hey, can you actually put together 48 minutes of this over the next 20 games or whatever it's going to be? And so far, JR, I mean, they've done it since, I mean, really the first two games of the Chicago series were decent off defensively as well. But, yeah, it was really interesting. Like I think it was what's the phrase where it's almost like, oh, you guys forgot about us?
Yeah.
Like you forgot like what we can do.
I believe it starts with the words, nowadays everybody wanna talk, like they got something to say, but other comes out. Okay, never mind. I'm not gonna keep going. Keep going. Sorry.
But I mean, look, Boston deserves their flowers, man. I mean, they did it in the regular season. Sorry about that. They did it in the regular season, and it you know, they've been so good against, look, Brooklyn maybe wasn't, you know, totally shut down, but they did sweep the Nets, and we all talked about what the Nets meant to the nation apparently, and like what everyone thought they were going to be. So yeah, man, it was really impressive. And we'll see what the counterpunch is now from Ime Udoka and the Celtics, but I think the Bucks, we've seen them sustain it. So I don't think we're going to see this necessarily go away. There might be a slip or two, you know, of course, but it man, I don't know, JR. I think the Bucks found something at the end of that Chicago series, and how can you, now it's almost like, how can you doubt that they can't keep it up? Cause we've seen it before.
I think from a national perspective, it's understandable why the Celtics would be favored to win this series. I certainly understand it. They have the home court advantage. They've been the best team in the NBA since January. They're still a very, very good team. The Bucks don't have Chris Middleton. One of their three best players is injured. So of course, and we talked about what that meant for them defensively. So of course you're going to expect the Boston Celtics to come out and possibly, you know, possibly win this series in even fewer than seven games. Like, I don't think that's unfair. You see guys like Kendrick Perkins saying that at halftime, when it was only 56-46, it wasn't a blowout or anything, saying, oh, I changed my prediction. I now think the Bucks are going to win. I love the shifting of gears a little bit that you're seeing nationally, but you could also, I mean, how many times has game one not gone the way that the rest of the series has gone? You wrote about the last time the Bucks won a road game one. That was back against the Raptors in 2017. A very nice win. The Bucks lost that series in six games. You know, the Bucks lost the Eastern Conference Finals at home to Atlanta. How'd the rest of that series go? They didn't even need Giannis for the last two games of that series. So, you know, and we've talked about the Bucks struggling in game ones and winning the series. So like this is going to be about the next adjustment. It's going to be what Boston does now to counteract what the Bucks were able to do to them. And I'd be curious what you think those adjustments might look like. I mean, I would say that slowing down Giannis, that's something Giannis had a triple double in game one, but he wasn't great. Like, he missed a lot of shots around the rim, especially. Like, I feel like defensively they did their job on Giannis, and I don't know what the next move is that's going to dramatically sort of curtail what the Bucks are able to do. What do you think? What is Boston's next move? How are they going to attack what Milwaukee put on film here from game one?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, they put up 53s, JR. I mean, they set a franchise record. I think the Bulls put up 53s in one of those games as well. And go figure, JR, like if the Celtics had hit half of those or a quarter, what are we talking about today? Oh no, the Bucks giving up too many threes, man. Like, what are they going to do with the threes? I mean, this is like the Mike Budenholzer defense, you know, protect the paint, protect the rim, let them shoot a bunch of threes because the math says they're not going to make that many, right? So on one hand, I feel like the Celtics may just say, we're not going to miss that many open shots, or we're not going to miss that many clean threes, whatever, however teams like to say it, right? So I think there's an element of they're not going to wildly change too much because they feel like the ball's going to go in the basket a little bit. I think they're two stars, Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, have to score. You know, the Celtics were 0 for 11 from the mid-range area before the starters were pulled. They only made 10 two-point field goals. That, I think, has to change. How they do that, I don't know if it's trying to get Robert Williams III and Al Horford a little more active inside. I mean, Horford made four threes. Robert Williams had a couple like tip slams that got everybody crazy. But, you know, I don't know that I feel, Jay, they need to figure something out because you do need to make a few two pointers, right? Like, you're not going to hit 40 threes to score 120 points. So I think if you're the Bucks, you just kind of go in and ready to do the same thing. And if you're the Celtics, you kind of hope your two stars make a few more shots and maybe create a few more easier looks for your teammates and maybe be willing to make a couple 15-footers. Because what other way to get the Bucks out of the paint, right, JR? Like it's not just – like, they're conceding the three. So maybe not conceding, you know what I mean. They're going to let you shoot 53s. But if you want to pull Giannis and Brooke and Bobby out of there, or even Drew out of there, you know, you might need to make a few more DeMar DeRozan-styled 15, 18-footers. So we'll see. We'll see what Ime Udoka kind of, you know, pulls up for those guys. They're not a mid-range shooting team. That's not what they do. But I don't know if missing a bunch of threes is going to get those guys out of the paint. So it'll be interesting. I think the Bucks are going to kind of roll with this, JR. You know, it worked once. You stole one on the road. Why not try to steal two? But to your point when you started this, look, if the Bucks had lost this game and if they lose the next one, what are we saying? Well, Bucks went down 0-2 in Brooklyn. Bucks went down 0-2 in Phoenix. So I think it applies the other way. Like, I don't think we can sit here and be like, yep, Bucks, they're going to cruise through this thing because they stole one on the road in Boston. No, I think you have to give the Celtics a little bit of respect in that way and expect them to make some sort of offensive adjustment that allows their stars to get freed up a little bit.
You're mentioning the mid-range game reminds me of back in 2019 when they faced that Raptors team. Kawhi Leonard just ate him for lunch at mid-range, and that was ultimately kind of their undoing. Here it's a little bit different. And you know, what strikes me about those three-point takes, a lot of times Celtics are trying to move the ball around inside. They're trying to get a look, but the defense is so physical and so intense, they ultimately just kind of bounce back to the three-point line. And then they've taken a shot deep in the play in the shot clock, and they've been pushed around a little bit. So, like, yeah, they're probably not going to be that fresh. You know, it's not like a wide-open three at the beginning of the, you know, on a fast break or anything. This is stuff they've worked for, and you know, they clank off the back of the rim because they're probably tired at that point. Like, there is still a defensive component to allowing them that many shots from outside the arc. 10 makes from inside, that's the fewest of any Boston Celtics playoff performance in their history, which, of course, is very rich. So this is really kind of heady stuff, what they were able to do. What about Chris Middleton's health? Now, it was reported that he's definitely not going to be, well, shouldn't say definitely, but reported by Adrian Wojnarowski and others that he won't be around for any point in this series, most likely, as he recovers from an MCL strain, which apparently is a grade 2 strain. Actually, I said Adrian Wojnarowski, but I think that's a sham scoop. I don't want to give credit to the wrong guy. Shams Charania from The Athletic. I don't know if there's still a possibility, if the Bucks are holding out hope, that maybe he could get in. There is a lot of time between Game 2 and Game 3 of this series, and then Game 3 and 4 back at American – oh, geez, I'm already Brewers and Bucks podcasts are crossing in my head. Back at Pfizer Forum, the Bucks don't play then until May 7th, until Saturday, after their Tuesday Game 2, and then again on Monday. So there is a lot of time there. But it doesn't sound promising, of course. Have you heard anything differently? And heck, maybe there's a meditation here looking at Jaylen Brown coming off a hamstring injury who really struggled in game one. Maybe there's something to be said for holding a guy out versus having a guy who's at not 100% playing. You know, maybe the latter is just as detrimental to a team, obviously depending on the guy. But I found that an interesting sort of juxtaposition too.
Yeah, so going back, you're right. It was reported just before. So let's rewind it quickly for those listeners jumping into the PFP. Maybe they missed us, a week ago. Chris Middleton's getting looked at Wednesday when the team returns from Boston. Okay, that was always the plan. It was never said that he will get back on the court 2 weeks from his injury. It was, okay, let's see what he's doing. Let's see where, how it's healed, how he feels. So to your point, JR, your reference, yes, the Athletic report that he would be done, like just done for the Celtics series, no matter what, potentially for anything beyond. And how do I say this? I was not able to, it's not to say it isn't true or could happen, but I wasn't able to get anything that definitive. From people I talk to who know the situation. So my understanding is we record this, JR. Sure, Chris Middleton could be out till an Eastern Conference final or to a final, but I think the key thing was no one was ready to tell me it's for sure that's the case. You know what I mean? Like, it's a ligament injury in a knee. It's not totally torn. He's not, like, done for the season, like a blown ACL or totally ruptured MCL, or right? Like, so with that, there's always a gray area, because at some point they're going to say, this is what it is. Chris, are you good with that? How does it feel? Can you play on it? Is it hurt? Or the doctors are going to say, well, this is what it is. If you play on it, it could totally go. We don't know yet, right? And that's, I mean, JR, I mean, I've been doing NFL podcasts and writing on this stuff for years. Like, it's just, unless it's ruptured and the guy's out, it's always shades of gray. And it's always individual timing. You know, Chris hyperextended that knee in December. We have no idea if this was weakened because of that, if it's totally unrelated, if it's somehow related. We know he's not Giannis, because Giannis is a freak. And like, that should never count for anything. It's like Adrian Peterson, JR, coming back from an ACL in what, like 5 months and something, like there's just something you can't even play that game of like, well, this, if this guy, then this guy. So I would say it's fair to think Chris is going to be out for what, four, the first four games of the series. I felt that way from the beginning. And then it was, okay, what does it look like after that? I think we'll find out, you know, we'll know a little more here between this podcast and our next one, I feel. But yeah, I don't know if it's that definitive, JR. And I think if you're the Bucks, you have found a good matchup. Chris Middleton's a Boston killer, if you will. That's true. He has played really well. But this current iteration of the Bucks, they've got something for the Celtics here, rolling out these three bigs. You know what I mean? And so you're not better without an all-star. I'm going to maintain that. But the Bucks, as they've won four straight without him.
Yeah, four straight handily too. They've not really come down to the wire in any of these games by any stretch.
No.
So that is remarkable. And you know, you talked about guys kind of filling in with Bobby Portis in the starting lineup. You know, I don't know if Bobby Portis has gotten just that much better on defense, or if somehow the Bucks are able to work it so that the Celtics weren't able to attack him as a mismatch. But, you know, Bobby Portis was not a liability at any point here in this game against the Celtics. And really, it's same really holds true for the whole playoffs at this point. That was the knock on him coming into this year with his renewed contract with the Bucks. Like, okay, well, he's a good energy guy. He's great off the bench, good offense. But defensively, can he hold up in this situation? And you saw Javon Carter a lot, too. That's a guy we didn't think we'd see a whole lot of in the postseason. But here he is doing great things, including on defense, and willing to take a shot when he has to. You know, like the Bucks seem to just, it seems like everybody really is clicking at the right time. It's that sort of cliche of peak in the playoffs or whatever, but honestly it feels like that's exactly what we've seen. Games one and two, that Bulls series aside, we're seeing kind of the best version of the Bucks. And I guess I'm mostly curious here about Bobby Portis. Like, has he surprised you the way that he's been able to hold his own defensively, or are the Bucks doing something to ensure that whatever shortcomings he may have on defense does not bubble up here against this Boston Celtics team?
No, I think there is help defense. I mean, Bobby is definitely helped by having Jrue Holiday, Wes Matthews in front of him, and Giannis and Brooke beside him and behind him. And he'd be the first to say it. But I think Bobby Portis is 2 years in this league, JR. If you were to zoom out of Bobby and Bobby bifocals and all this stuff, if you were to truly zoom out and look at a guy who is in his now late 20s, had played for three different teams prior to, like, he, you know, after, you know, it's not like he came into the league at 19. I mean, he was 20, but, you know, he had a track record, six seasons in the league, or five seasons in the league, you know, at the age of 23. So yeah, he was, or 24. So he was young, quote unquote, but like sometimes guys like that at that spot, JR, you're like, okay, that's who that is. How much better is that kind of player really going to get? And what did the Bucks find? The Bucks found a guy who suddenly could shoot 40% from the 3-point line. That in and of itself is insane. if you really think about who Bobby Portis was prior to this. And then to your point, Jar, the defensive element, yeah, he's better. He is better. He is a better defender this year than last year. He was a better defender last year than any point in his career previously. That's a lot of credit to Bobby Portis, JR. That's a guy, you want to talk about what buy-in looks like. You want to talk about, you know, culture of a locker room, all these sort of intangible things we all like to talk about and people like to yell and scream about on sports talk radio. Like, Bobby Portis is the embodiment of all of that. And it's a lot of credit to him that he learned how to switch and be able to play that capably enough where, you know, you're not sort of like flashing the double and help him just because somebody hunted him out, you know, that he can hold his own just enough that he knows where to go and what to do. That's a great point, JR. I'm glad you kind of brought that up because it's so easy to kind of get lost in the fun parts of Bobby's game. but he, I don't know, man. He's made himself so much money, in my opinion, JR. I think that means Milwaukee will never see him again, except on an opposite sideline or maybe when he rolls through town to, like, open up a restaurant or something. But, I mean, that's a great point. It really is, JR. And he's a big, big reason why they've been able to do this. And that's on the defensive end.
PJ Tucker and Bobby Portis, examples of guys who are going to play for other teams in the very, you know, now, in the next year, and still be highly beloved and be able to drink for free anytime they come back to Milwaukee, especially if they win the title again. Bobby Portis, they'll just build a statue of him with his headband. that will be a love affair that will never cease to exist. Hey, speaking of Jrue Holiday, it is notable, something I kind of really didn't think about until I watched this game. Marcus Smart was named Defensive Player of the Year in the NBA this year. First time a guard has won that since Bucks legend Gary Payton back in 1996. The Holiday wasn't really in the running for that, and I think there's still, you know, you watch Smart play, I still think there's a really healthy argument to be made that guards probably shouldn't win that award. It should probably be a big man, because big men simply impact the game defensively more than guards can. Not that he's not a great defender. He is. Everyone knows it. But Jrue Holiday wasn't really even tangential to that conversation for DPOY, except maybe in our minds. And Jrue Holiday is, as we've seen, one of the best defensive guards out there. There were times he did kind of take over that game, Jrue Holiday, and I don't know if it's like the mano-a-mano with Marcus Smart that maybe brought his game to another level, but I really felt like Jrue Holiday's impact was pretty substantial. And offensively, we've talked about some of the hiccups he's had in the postseason, both last year and again this year. I don't know if we're seeing that as much. Like, I there's still some turnovers, but I feel like that's sort of the embodiment of that Bucks sort of we're the champion mentality, and if we struggle in the outset, we're not going to let that permeate the rest of the game or the rest of our game. And Jrue Holiday really impressed me. What did you see from him in this game against Boston?
Yeah, I saw exactly that, Jared. I mean, that was one of the reasons, you know, that I wrote before the playoff run started of why they could repeat. And it was because Jrue Holiday had developed into a closer in the fourth quarter. He wasn't hitting game winning shots per se, but, you know, scoring 8 points a quarter in the fourth more than Giannis or Chris was a big deal. And that was something he wasn't doing last year. And he didn't do throughout the playoffs. He's doing it right now. He did it against the Bulls. He struggled with his shot just as much as Giannis did in game one in Boston. And guess who scores 17 points in the second half? Right? Like, it's Jrue Holiday. So you're right. The offense is there for him. The defense has always been there. And I think, he had said this to me with the Marcus Smart thing. He was so happy to see Marcus win the award because, you know, there's a lot of professional respect there. He's like, look, Marcus Smart will guard Giannis. You know, I'm going to guard Jason Tatum. Like, and then we're also going to take our turns with the other four guys at times. And he felt like, things that he does, he wasn't saying I should be DPOY, but like there's a little bit of, hey, like we can do some stuff too at a really elite level. And so he was happy to see a guard finally win it. But to this series, yeah, I mean, look, the Wes Matthews thing can't be understated here, JR, because it's given, unlike last year, where PJ helped with Durant, but PJ wasn't going to guard Chris Paul. You know what I mean? Where, like, I think Wes has given Jrue a little bit of a breather with DeMar DeRozan or Zach LaVine or Jason. Like, that's helped these first two series. I think it will continue to help. Who knows who they see if they continue to advance. But I think for now, we've seen the best of Jrue largely because Wes has been there to sort of take all those body blows. And you mentioned earlier in the podcast, Jared, like the Celtics feeling the effects of these fourth quarters. I would venture to say one of the reasons Jrue has been so good in fourth quarters is he's not having to exert all of the effort, all of the time in quarters one through three. This is a little bit of a credit to Javon Carter as well. Grayson Allen has really stepped up defensively since Chris got hurt. And so I think, And Drew said this. He's like, it's not just me. Like, it's all these guys. And that's true. But Drew is so good. He's the tip of the sword to a degree. With Giannis and Brooke being, I don't know, bad sword metaphor here for their Last Kingdom stuff. But, you know, whatever the whatever the heavy weight is down at the bottom, like, maybe that's what the other guys are. The power behind it, I don't know. But, yeah, JR, it's Drew, we're seeing, you know, Drew Holiday kind of peaking, which is what obviously the Bucks gambled on with the extension into his 30s. And it's, look, they're going to need all of it to keep going without Chris Middleton.
I am ashamed that I have not said the name Wes Matthews prior to now, because he was awesome, as you said. He's been a big part of their defensive shape as well. So my bad. The pommel, I think, is the name of the bottom of a sword. There might be other words. Other swords might have a, you know,
there's
I'm not,
a hilt in there.
There's got to be a hilt somewhere. Aquilian, is that the thing that kind of, like, you know, like the little wings that kind of come out? I don't know. I'm talking off the top of my head, and I might be making stuff up, but. I'm not a big fantasy guy. Sorry about that. But yes, Wes Matthews has been awesome.
Is it just fantasy stuff here? Do you not like ninjas? I mean, are you not in, like, He-Man? Did you not watch He-Man? Are you just not into swords in general?
No.
Are you anti-sword?
I did watch He-Man as a kid, but that wasn't one of my faves, I would say. No, I'm definitely, and I was into Game of Thrones like everybody else, and that had plenty of sword work, I guess. I don't know. It's just not my wheelhouse. I'm more of a science fiction guy, which sometimes dovetails with the sort of, like, I don't know, medieval aesthetic, but not often. So, hey, before we get to our weekly features here, I wanted to mention or wanted to ask about that. Selfie Slam. I think Lori Nickel, our colleague, suggested that as a possible name. I love that. I think we should absolutely go with it. When you saw the alley-oop that Giannis threw off the backboard to himself for the dunk, which, by the way, is now in the book of Giannis. I keep track of his 30 greatest plays as a Milwaukee Buck. You better believe that made the list. Did you look at the bench right away? Are you trained enough when Giannis does something superhuman to just look at the bench reactions? Because that is a tapestry. It is a beautiful, it's a work of art. You have just have to figure out which one you are. Tag yourself, which member of the Bucks bench you are when something like that happens. What's going through your head when you see that play go down?
Yeah, okay, this is where, well, it's appropriate. This is before the what makes Jim mad, because I think this suits my personality. Like, I've seen Giannis already do that several times this
right
year.
Against the Timberwolves, he did it around four defenders.
Yeah, so, like, on one hand, JR, I'm like, and he's talked about how, yeah, it's instinct. He doesn't really plan for it until he gets to a point where he's stuck and he has nowhere else to go other than turn the ball over. So I'm going to do this thing. So it made total sense to me that he did it. I've seen it before. That's not to say it's not cool. Like, context matters. This is way different than some random regular season game. And I'd make a note of it, like, in my running play-by-play. I got a star next to it, and I do a description in case we're going to write about it. but it's kind of like, all right, there's a dunk, and you're coming back the other way. I'm not saying I don't appreciate an all-time great player doing all-time great things in front of me. That is not the case.
Oh, but what you're saying is you were bored. You were bored by it. It did nothing for you. You were bored.
Yeah, I'm kind of – I'm like, that's cool. Like, that's like, you know – the thing Giannis does, as opposed to, you know, a Jordan fadeaway or a Magic no look. I mean, whatever, you know, whatever the signatures are for all these all-time greats. But yeah, I mean, I appreciate it. But I definitely was just like, all right, I wrote down and okay, now they're coming back. They're coming back the other way.
Jim Ozarski, not an appreciator of Giannis's Mona Lisa's. Very very shameful. Very shameful, Jim. Very disappointing. All right, let's move into let's roll this down here. We'll start with our weekly features, as we do on every Tuesday edition of the Point Forward Podcast. We're starting with One Quick Buck.
Desmond Mason. Woo-hoo! With authority. Man.
Monte Ellis puts it up at the buzzer and got it.
No way.
Monte Ellis wins the game and then heads to the locker.
You gotta be kidding me, Charlie Villanueva. He has got the mojo going.
To the bell, man. In your face, Brad Lohan.
The Milwaukee Bucks select Larry Sanders from Virginia Commonwealth University. Larry is not here.
One Quick Buck.
going with a suggestion here this week from a friend of mine, John Casper, who, longtime preps reporter out in the western part of Wisconsin, native of the Milwaukee area, big Bucks guy. He recommended somebody that is timely for a number of reasons. Today we're going with John Lucas, former Milwaukee Bucks player John Lucas in the 1980s. Jim, any thoughts on John Lucas? He's been in a number of NBA capacities. Anything jump to mind for you?
Is this the same John Lucas who was more involved with getting guys like back healthy and more off the court?
Oh yeah, stuff. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I feel like when you say John Lucas, I think more of the coach and the sort of mentor to many.
Yes.
That's what pops to mind immediately.
Absolutely. And that's a big part of his story. He runs a wellness center for substance abuse recovery. He was a longtime coach with the Spurs, 76ers, Cavaliers, great tennis player, I believe, if Wikipedia is to be believed, a nationally ranked tennis player when he was at Maryland. But he's interesting for a couple reasons that are timely. John Lucas was the number one overall pick in the 1976 NBA draft by the Houston Rockets. He played two seasons with the Bucks, 86-87 and 87-88. He was very good. That first year in particular, he averaged more than 12 points a game, 5.5 assists over the two seasons, but especially that first season, he was 17.5 points a game, 6.7 assists, 1.7 steals. He's in the top 100 in the NBA all time in steals. Actually, Drew Holiday is five away from passing him, so that name might come up again next year. But especially he was good in the 1987 playoff series against the Celtics, the Eastern Conference semifinals. The Bucks had just picked him up for that season. He threw up 16.9 points per game, 30 points in game three, which is a wild, wild game that I'll tell you about a little more about in a second. But that was against the Celtics. Celtics had just won the 1986 championship. Tremendous, all-world team, that 86 Celtics team. And the Bucks took them toe-to-toe, lost ultimately in seven games in 87. But Lucas was only available because he'd been waived by Houston. He'd had several run-ins and suspensions for drug addiction, drug abuse. He'd been released in June of 1988. Or I should say the Bucks released him in June of 1988, but not because of that. They just were going in a different direction. But he's been very open about his cocaine addiction and the struggles he had with substance abuse. It seems like he's the second stage of his life has been dedicated to sort of helping others who have the similar problems. It's gone very well for him. The NBA instituted a three strikes and you're out program in 83. Two of Lucas's previous infractions came before that, so he was on. When he joined the Bucks, he'd already had two official strikes, so he really couldn't afford a third one, or he would have been banned from the league. But he was very good. The Bucks kind of took a flyer on him, and he talked about all that stuff. He was open about it, and he ended up working out pretty well, I would say, for the Milwaukee Bucks. Now he's also in the news not just because he had a good showing against the Celtics, but his son Jai Lucas is a assistant coach in college basketball. He was actually at Texas as an assistant with Shaka Smart when Shaka Smart, who's now the Marquette University coach, was at Texas. But then Lucas moved on to become an assistant at Kentucky. He just defected from Kentucky to John Shire's staff at Duke. He's one of the top assistants in college basketball. This is John Lucas's son. He had another son, John Lucas III, who also played at Oklahoma State. So the name, a lot of people know the name and the family, and they've had a lot of success in basketball. So first game with the Bucks, he scored like 12 points and 7 assists right away against the Hawks and led a big second half comeback. So he ingratiated himself right away. That playoff game again, that game 3 game where he scores 30 points, many Bucks fans will remember that as the game Kevin McHale fouls out with 24 seconds left. And he winds up turning around. There's a fan, a Bucks fan in the first row at the arena, being verbally abusive, being a problem. He was wearing a tie, and McHale turns around and grabs the fan by the tie. And there's kind of like this melee right in front of the bench in the final moments of this game. It was a weird moment, and a lot is going on for the Bucks. That's Don Nelson's last year. There's rumors that he's going to the Knicks. He ends up leaving for the Warriors, but it's pretty clear that relationship is broken. At the time, two Bucks players, Paul Mokeski and Jack Sikma, were whispered about being involved in a gambling ring. Those charges were eventually dropped, but they were tied up in that for a little bit. So there is a whole lot going on. Lucas has this great game, scores 12 of his 30 points in the fourth. Celtics had a 2-0 lead in the series at the time, so that brought the Bucks back within one. Celtics did go up 3-1 in the series. Bucks forced that seventh game, but ultimately fell short. So Lucas was the fourth leading scorer in that series behind Sikma, Terry Cummings, and Sidney Moncrief, played a big role, and then moved on. So I don't know if a lot of people associate John Lucas with the Milwaukee Bucks, but uh, He was here for a couple of years and was here at a very interesting time. Those late '80s, mid to late '80s Bucks teams, sort of a crazy time, and that is this week's One Quick Buck. So we are now at the final point of our podcast episode where we discuss my favorite topic of the week. It is what's making Jim mad.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I am very disappointed.
I'm upset.
Louder!
I'm upset!
Say it louder!
I'm upset!
That's my secret, Cap. I'm always angry.
What's making Jim mad?
So I'm going to take on... Jay, I'm not afraid of anything. So I'm going to take on...
Fearless.
I'm going to take on a... You know, they've got, what is it called? Big tech. There's big pharma. There's big whatever, right?
We've discussed about like big pickle, big avocado, big cucumber.
These machines that just, you know, that's what we do. You know, I take these things on you know what makes me mad, JR? Big hippo.
Big hippo.
Big
what?
Hippo.
I love hippos.
Makes me mad.
Big hippo.
There is no, I don't understand how a giant walking death machine.
It's going to be good.
Just skates through with like, oh, they're so cute. They're so amazing. You watch a National Geographic or a Netflix or some Earth thing. And when they get to the hippo, it's this like light, airy music. And it's so cute. Look at it in the mud and in the water. Nah, man. Hippos are mean. They will eat you. They will eat everything. They will swim fast and like smash your boat. Nah, I'm tired of it. Like, what's up with big hippo? Hippos. No one wants anything to do with hippos, and yet that somehow I don't understand it. I mean, it is like some of the best PR of all time, and it's not true. It's not true.
Did you get a chance?
Hippos will eat you.
Did you go to the Boston Zoo? Is that part of the trip?
No, I was watching another documentary, and I see this like all this fun, airy music come around these hippos. Nah, man. It's like, I'm like, this is not fun. They're not fun. They're not cute. They're not fun. They'll eat your face. Not think twice about it. How do they get away with this?
Oh, I love it, Jim. I have a thought. Well, first of all, the Milwaukee County Zoo recently rebuilt its hippo habitat. It's a very centrally located habitat, and the hippo I think they have two of them actually, and she's a big deal. People want to see her. She might be a mean killing machine, giant mean killing machine, but she's got this lovely habitat. Kids love her. Kids just want to know more about the hippos. So I hear what you're saying. You know what it is, Jim? It's that they're fat. Fat people are underestimated in terms of their violence, don't you think? I mean, fat people are adorable. Who doesn't love a giant fat animal? Like panda bears? Love them. Everyone loves pandas. Sloths seem kind of like, well, sloths are more about being, they're more about being slow, of course, but, you know, they're just kind of poofy. People, I think, love poofy. They love, at least maybe I'm only speaking for myself. The fatter, the better, Jim. I think hippos are adorable. I absolutely want to hang out with one, even though, yes, I acknowledge that it can outrun me, outswim me, and will kill me. But that's the reason. And furthermore, I think hippos would be a great team mascot name. I mean, hippos are ferocious. You think of like New Orleans Pelicans. You know what would have been great? I mean, the Pelicans are great, actually. That's perfect. But New Orleans hippos would be just as like fearsome. But what you're saying is people, and I think this is true, people would be like, oh, that's a dumb nickname. You know, what are you going to be like, the flamingos? Or like they'd be compared with less, less violent creatures. But in reality, the hippo is probably as fierce as anything in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, it's I don't know. It's just, yeah, they're, look, I got total respect for the hippo. It has nothing to do with the animal itself.
Shout out to the hippo.
It's the construct. They're amazing. You ever see a hippo swim? No. You want to know why? Because it's scary and they're going to come eat you. I'm telling you, man. Like, so I got no problem with the hippo himself. It's the construct. So yeah, go learn about the hippo, kid, but learn the real hippo. Are they learning about the real hippo, JR? Are they learning about the real hippo? I don't know. I doubt it. The kids coming home say, hey, this thing's super cool and it's cute, and I want a little baby hippo as a pet, then big hippo won again. I'm telling you, it's a problem. It's making me mad.
This is definitely why people tune into this podcast. I love this. This is my favorite edition so far of this is the best. What's making Jim mad so far? I'm a big fan of what we got going on here. The Milwaukee Bucks will be back in action on Tuesday night, 6 o'clock tip time central, I believe, in Boston. And if they can somehow come out with game two, well, then they can come home and with a real realistic chance of winning the series in four or five games. This is a hot start. The Miami Heat and Sixers awaiting the winner of this one. Sixers without Joel Embiid. Joel Embiid, it's looking like Miami is going to be the team to beat in that one. But hey, maybe that's the same thing as Chris Middleton disappearing for the Bucks. Can't count out the team. Can't count out the Sixers. That seems like a little different situation, but that'll be another series to watch. And Jim, we will be back at it here in a week. Only two games are going to go by the time we're podcasting again. So we will chat with you again very soon.
Talk to you then.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody, to the Point Forward Podcast. Find us on Twitter. I'm at JR Radcliffe. He's at Jim Ozarski. Let us know how we did. Feel free to recommend one quick buck or, heck, recommend things that are making Jim mad. Maybe he'll take you up on it. Big hippo, man. find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Thanks for tuning in. We'll chat with you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Point Forward Podcast, a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and JSOnline.com production.